Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Adam Folds on his latest novel, Dream Sequence. Adam Folds' most recent books are In the Wolf's Mouth, The Quickening Maze, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and won the Encore Award and the European Union Prize for Literature, and The Broken Word, which won the Costa Poetry Award and the Somerset Maugham Award. He has recently been awarded the E.M. Forster Award by the American Academy of Arts and Letters and named as one of Granter's best young British novelists. And Adam's latest book, Dream Sequence, we're going to talk about today. Adam, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe Dream Sequence?
Dream Sequence is a slightly fevered short novel that is wrapped up in the experiences of two characters. Henry, who is an actor who has become very successful in one television programme, which has now ended after a few seasons. This one lucky bit of casting having carried him further than he'd expected. He's now being ejected at the end of that, and in a state of anxious ambition, he's looking for the next thing. He's looking to become a star, to become a well-known and notably versatile actor. So we follow him. He is preparing for an audition when we first meet him with a kind of European art house director who he thinks will give him a lot of cachet and help boost him in the way that he wants. He is starving himself for a few days for that audition because that's a role, should he get it, that would require some body transformation of the kind we're familiar with, certain actors have undergone. So that's Henry. Wrapped around Henry's story is that of a character called Kristin, who is an American in Philadelphia. She has met Henry on one occasion, and when she did so, in a state of some kind of emotional disarray at that point, had an experience akin to a religious experience, in which it was revealed to her that the universe is essentially loving and safe, and that she and Henry are destined to be together. And she is determined and sets about, in the course of the novel, to bring this about.
Yeah, we can say she's met Henry, but Henry didn't really meet her in the
same way. No, Henry met her in the way that he might meet any fan in an airport and not think too much about it. But for Kristin, it was life-changing and utterly kind of clarifying of her destiny.
I want to talk about Kristin first. And when we first meet her, she's just recently divorced. But, I mean, and she has a sort of, I guess, rather a fraught relationship with her own family. And indeed, probably her, you know, most intimate relationship is with her young stepson. Yeah. But she's, you know, she's a woman of some privilege. She's not, you know, she's... Let's talk about the position she's in when we first meet her in the book.
So she comes from a working-class background, and she became the PA to a successful businessman, and that turned, as those relationships can, into a romantic relationship. He divorced his first wife, married her, She was lifted up into a world of, as you say, privilege and money that she certainly was not used to before. And then, just as her kind of potentially child-rearing, child-bearing years are passing, he divorces her and moves on to his third wife. He's described as the kind of guy who, you know, who would want to have a third wife on his CV. So she is then spat out. She has a settlement. She's living in a small house in Philadelphia on her own. And for the time being, she doesn't have any strong pressure to get a job, which means there's all the more room for her interest in Henry to kind of expand and exfoliate.
Yeah, exactly. And all of these reasons, the situation that she's in, the fact that she has this leisure time, make it sort of perfect for this fantasy, this dream relationship to percolate, doesn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right, yeah.
So what does Kristen think happened when she meets Henry in the airport?
I think she thinks that she saw reality and that her twin soul was present in Henry and that she had a deep experience of knowing. As I say, very akin to a religious experience and therefore, in a similar way, opaque to people around her. You know, she is driven by faith in an invisible reality.
Now, obviously, we're not going to talk about too much about what happens in the book, but it does give away in the blurb on the leaf that she travels to, basically follows Henry to London, and then, you know, things happen. I want to talk about this idea of the stalker. Well, have you had any experience of that yourself?
Yeah, I have some experience, and I've seen it unfold somewhat. But I would say that actually what I'm interested in Kristen's psychology and why she is not written in a kind of psychopathic true crime style is that she is on a continuum with the way all of us think in a magical way from time to time. Anyone falling in love is overcommitting to an ideal. Anytime you think this is destined to happen, I was fated to meet this person, we are meant to be together, you are in that realm of thinking about the universe having some invisible intent that is guiding the shape of your life. And she's, I think, broadly speaking, you could say that stalkers can be divided into people like Kristen who are mystical and actually kind of sweet and committed to an idea of love and connection, and the more typical stalker who is predatory, typically a kind of jilted boyfriend who then pursues the ex. So, yeah, Kristen, as I say, is someone who is committed to an ideal of love that to some extent we all share. Hers is very boundary crossing and is an exacerbated example of, you know, part of all our psyche, which is kind of iridescent and weird.
And also, I mean, we'll talk more about this when we move on to talk about Henry in more detail, but the idea of celebrity culture itself, which obviously is all nowadays in this age of social media, is even more saturating than it was before. And in his own way, Henry is as caught up in this idea of, you know, pursuing the dream of celebrity culture as Kristen is.
He is. They're both beset by desire. They're both dangerously committed to a future that they have to bring about. So Henry is still persuaded that there is a level of success, a breakthrough that can come in his life that will lift him clear of his anxieties and will make everything safe. And again, that's a thing that we experience in some form every time we indulge in that thought that if this one thing would just happen, then everything would be okay. If we could get this job, if such and such occurred, then our life would be sorted. So, yeah, and his story is the success and failure of that. And there is some intimation, there's some exploration of the space that is in a phrase of Philip Larkin's, fulfillment's desolate attic, you know, the achieving something and finding that it doesn't sustain and gratify you in the way that you want, and then committing to the next achievement in a kind of endless reigniting hope.
So let's talk more about Henry Banks said. So as you said, he's just come off the back of this sort of middle-brow Sunday night. Think Downton Abbey, basically, The Grange.
Which I may have done.
Yes. The show that, you know, he's obviously been, you know, massively popular and has put him in everybody's living rooms. And that's finished now. Tell us where Henry comes from.
Henry comes from a general sense of a kind of neurosis that's in the culture. This is a book in which I wanted to kind of grapple with things that seem very striking and lurid at times in our contemporary culture around the idea of fame, the idea of success, the idea of curating, as you know, one would now say, curating oneself. All things that, again, many people do in their Instagram feeds and their Facebook photos and the like. It's about all those things that are going on. What, obviously, Henry, being undeniably a successful actor, is in a very privileged position in society, but an actor's life is also remains uncertain and remains subject to a, you know, possible rapid fade away.
Yeah, it's a life of constant rejection.
It's a life of constant rejection, and it is therefore a life in which some of the more anxieties about precarity that are more generally shared in society are experienced also.
And as you mentioned with the sort of Philip Larkin idea, he's, you know, he has this amazing career that anybody would envy, but he's constantly unsatisfied, empty, basically, and you know, literally illustrated by the fact that for this art house role that he's going for, he's basically, you know, starving himself in that sort of like method acty way. What has he got to be dissatisfied about?
Oh, well, that's not amenable to kind of rational correction. I mean, it's in his personality. It's in lots of our personalities. You meet his parents a few times in the novel and you get a sense of maybe why it is that he has grown into an actor, why he has, that is to say, sought love and approval from strangers. It's a very typical feature of actors' biographies is a certain set of experiences and the denial of approval in childhood. I was very immersed in actors' biographies and interviews with them as I was building Henry, as to some extent we all are. I mean, they're extremely overestimated and overexposed people in our culture. There are, one might think, often much more interesting people to devote, you know, feature interviews in the Sunday supplements to than the latest young man who's getting to play Hamlet in the West End or whoever. When you talk about him feeling constantly unsatisfied and constantly anxious, I think for a number of very successful actors, there is no point at which that ceases. I saw an interesting interview with Dame Judi Dench a few years ago when she was asked what she thought about her competitors, if she thought about other actresses who might be up for the role that she's up for, or, you know, people that she'd come up with, the Maggie Smiths or whoever over the years who might have been up for the same jobs as she was. And she said very kind of coolly that she felt them all the time, and she gestured to her sort of left shoulder, that they were present in her peripheral vision all the time, which clearly indicates a, you know, a quite uncomfortable source for an endless determination to succeed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Adam Folds and we're talking about his latest novel, Dream Sequence. And Adam's just sticking with that, with Henry's world of, you know, the acting world. You've made a decision to basically set this book. It's basically, it's a novel, it's a fictional story, but set in the real world. So real named actors, you know, Michael Fassbender, Benedict Cumberbatch, are mentioned in the book as people that are in Henry's periphery, which also gives this... I mean, I guess I wanted to talk about where the title comes from as well, but this is... Kristen is constructing this fantasy world. Henry is living in this world of celebrity, but also there's this sort of like crossover between fact and fiction in the story as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it would seem absurd to invent a lot of actors' names just when, you know, people will immediately know who I'm talking about when I name them. And I find there's a little kind of buzz that you get when a nice line is produced about an actor that you know, that you can sort of recognise the work of description there. And also that it just immediately feels, therefore, connected to the real world, to your lived experience. What was the second part of that question? Was that...
Well, I mean, that was basically what I wanted to get to, the sort of the mixing, you know, why you made that decision to mix the fact and fiction. Oh, and also, yeah, let's talk about the title.
As a title, it just came to mind as something that just sort of sits in the middle of these various concerns of the novel. Dream Sequence obviously has a filmic connotation. I'm a big fan of dream sequences in cinema generally, like the one in Rosemary's Baby, for example, or Wild Strawberries. This is one of the best bits of cinema, I think. Dream obviously has a connotation of the desired thing, you know, your dream home, your dream kitchen, it would be my dream, etc. And at the same time, a connotation of the unreal and the delusional. So those two things are obviously working together in the book. And sequence, you know, there's, for both of them, as I say, they're deeply committed to ideas about the future and to a particular, at different times, different course of events unfolding. So the idea of the dream sequence as the ideal unfolding of their lives.
I wanted to talk about Henry describes film. He wants to get into film. Mm. You know, we see him doing Hamlet in the West End, and we know that he's been on TV, but his dream is to get into film. And he has this great idea, which is that film is basically like a historical artefact. Mm. You know, you can look back at a film now and everyone that's in it is probably dead, and but, you know, that thing will last forever. Tell me about that idea.
Well, again, I guess it's a version of the desire for escape and for stability, is the sense that he could produce a performance that would be perfected in its cinematography and in its final form and would last inexhaustibly forever, in the way that, you know, great film performances, I mean, obviously they're not generally not more than 100 years old, but they last and are revisitable and have an authority and a charisma in the culture that is very specific. Obviously theatre has extraordinary qualities and values that that people are deeply committed to, but there is something about the version of fame and the version of kind of charismatic selfhood that cinema offers in, you know, in its De Niro's, in the way that people do impressions of, you know, great scenes of movies and quote them and live with them in their minds and rewatch them. This is all stuff that Henry wants because he thinks it will, he will feel it and it will, yeah, it will release and establish him.
And so I wanted to talk about the genius film director, Miguel Garcia, that Henry is, you know, desperate to work for. He thinks this is going to elevate him. This is, you know, one of those European auteur filmmakers. And although, of course, you know, we are really only seeing our impression of Miguel Garcia through Henry's eyes, when he actually meets him and works with him, he's disappointed, I'd say.
Yes, perhaps not at first. They have fairly interesting conversation that we are witness to early on. But, well, this partly came out of conversations with actors that I know who have said that that people generally kind of really overestimate what directors give to actors, and the relationship between directors and actors, often it's extremely minimal and actors are just given their marks and told to go. And there isn't the kind of guru-like working together to generate a great performance that that lots of people imagine. It's a lot in the photography and in the editing and in what the actor themselves brings to the role. So I think that is partly what he's learning, that even someone like Miguel Garcia is not going to be the kind of ideal artistic parent that he imagines for himself.
There's also a there's a sequence in the book where Henry goes off to a film festival in Doha in Qatar, and you know, there's this world, this again as almost a dream world rising out of the desert that shouldn't really exist, and you know, is the sort of plaything of billionaires and is built by indentured workers. I wanted to know why you wanted to explore that. Have you been to one of these literary festivals out in Dubai or whatever?
I have been to Doha a couple of times in a literary capacity. And I was very struck by it and made a bunch of notes. And this was the venue where that material could be activated. But I was very, you know, as a writer, as someone therefore in some corner of the entertainment business, the sense that one has of existing in a space within larger economic system that is in lots of ways deeply vicious but allows you this little kind of corner of harmless play is something that I wanted to explore a bit in Henry's experience, the sense of being this little you know, pixie in a kind of wasteland.
And London as well, a lot of, obviously most of the book is set in London. Henry lives in an apartment in the Docklands. I just wanted to talk about writing London. What is it about London?
Well, I've lived here pretty much all my life, and therefore it's deeply kind of impressed on my senses. But I think I was interested in this book, particularly in the way that it has changed in the last 20 years, I guess, in many ways for the better, as a, you know, for the user experience. Trafalgar Square is a good example of a place where traffic was has been rationalised. When I was growing up, it, you know, it was not closed at the top. There was traffic all around. It was quite an awkward space to traverse. It was very quite grimy. There are lots of developments around London which have produced these much smoother, sleeker spaces to be in. And there's this kind of sheeny, glassy surface to lots of parts of London now that is an expression of where consumer capitalism has got to. And there, it's a strange bunch of sensations that I wanted to kind of record and pay attention to, often both seductive and slightly dejecting. You know, you feel a lack of kind of purchase in the texture, in the surface of the city. But at the same time, as I say, it's easy. It delivers, you know, tasty snacks whenever you want them, that kind of thing.
And sort of, you know, yeah, easier to live in, but sort of somehow depersonalised at the same time. And I guess that's sort of reflecting Henry's sort of the feeling that he has again, this sort of dissatisfaction constantly.
Yes, I think that's right. I think he is intended to be someone who's feeling both the seductions, the beguilements of the contemporary world and the way it's not connecting to his centre, and it's not giving him a way to live in itself. And he is simply expecting too much of it and looking for the wrong things in places that offer, you know, that seem to that present themselves as giving you all the life satisfactions that you require, but don't.
To what extent? I mean, obviously, as a, you know, as a Booker shortlisted author, not obviously to the extent of, you know, someone who's a TV star or a film star, but to what extent are you now expected to engage with this sort of always on world? You know, I know you're on Twitter. Are you expected by the publisher to have an Instagram feed and things like that? Do they?
I don't have an Instagram feed. I'm not really expected to do those things. I'm asked if I have them, but I'm not committed to it in any big way. There are some writers who've made a real art of their Twitter feeds and deploy them very well. There's a writer, American writer, Rabih Alameddine, who has a fantastic Twitter feed, is kind of constantly curating and putting together paintings and poems that he likes. And obviously, you know, part of his personality and his profile as a writer is manifest in that way. But yeah, it's a very unintensive kind of fame. If it's, fame is, it doesn't even feel like the right word for it. You know, a few people whom I haven't met know who I am. But really aren't, I don't think too many of them, and it's not long before I will meet them. And it doesn't in any way kind of impinge, or I don't even, you know, I'm completely unaware. The thought that there are readers out there who are interacting with my work and that I don't know about is really sort of out of my field of vision. I feel I live in a bunker, really.
So just one other thing then, and then I'll get you to read a bit of the book for us, if you would. You mentioned in the first part, in terms of researching, you know, Henry, obviously talking to actors, but also, you know, the celebrity biography and, you know, so many great ones of those there are. I just want to know what other sort of books were an influence on this one?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I had to hand, in the same way that I have done with other books, a bunch of books that are like feeding into it and that I'm resorting to for examples and to excite me. I think the writing that I like generally was, you know, has kept me buoyant in the writing of it. And there's some overlap. I'm thinking particularly of Saul Bellow and Don DeLillo, who both write urban. Don DeLillo particularly about kind of the glassier kind of the modern urban experience.
And also The Age of Celebrity.
And The Age of Celebrity, yeah. He's written very well about fame in both in Mao Tu and Great Jones Street. So they were there. I have pieces of music that I will listen to that become bound up with particular experiences or particular characters, and both Henry and Kristen had bits of music that I would occasionally listen to that reminded me of their worlds and enabled me to kind of re-enter them.
So to just get back into the mode of writing those characters.
Yes, exactly.
Can I get you to read us a little bit?
Sure. I'm now going to read the first time that we meet Henry, who, as I say, is in a state of anxious preparation for an audition with Miguel Garcia. The hunger was beginning to hurt. 3 days of grinding emptiness, of heat and sudden flutterings in the left side of his body. The relief of small meals in the evenings, monkish bowls of rice and green vegetables that he perceived so sharply, his senses attuned to the rising steam, the warmth and aroma. And afterwards, the velvety sensation of being fed that allowed him to fall asleep. In the morning he was hungry again. It was working. It was worth doing. He was becoming what he needed to be, to convince Garcia, who, finally, was in London to see him. But it would be a mistake to fast today. He needed energy. He went to his kitchen and ate a banana and 2 large handfuls of nuts. Enough food to relax and feel well, but not enough to dull his sharpness. He ate and hummed to himself. He dressed. He ran his hands down the smoothness of his abdomen. His body was tight. His trousers hung from his hip bones. He chose a khaki linen shirt with button-down pockets that he thought had the right sort of feel, serious, adaptable, with connotations of the military and the desert. Henry checked how he looked in the mirror. Henry's face was something everybody had to deal with, to assimilate and get over, even Henry. When Henry caught sight of his face, he often felt as though he were arriving late at something already happening. His face looked so finished and authoritative. He had the approved lines, the symmetry. He looked how a man should look. His handsomeness could be a shock as much for him as for others, who sometimes also had to process their recognition of him, their sensation of an untethered and inexplicable intimacy. Occasionally Henry thought that it would be nice, warm and relaxed and human, to be a little ugly, to have a face that showed personality in pouches under the eyes or a large soft mouth, the face of a character actor expressing suffering and humour. His own good looks were bland, Henry thought, mainstream, televisual. Hunger seemed to be improving it, its calm masculinity now fretted with sharpness and shadows. Henry had observed long ago that cinematic faces were not normally attractive, not attractive in a normal way. They did not belong on Sunday evening television or in clothing catalogues or any realm of the conventional ideals. The truly cinematic actors, that is. Look at Joaquin Phoenix with his dark, crushed stare and scarred mouth, or Meryl Streep's long, thin nose and subtle, not quite sensual mouth, her large and frightening eyes, her affronting vulnerability. All of them, when you thought about it, Christopher Walken, Jack Nicholson, Bogart and Hoffman and Day-Lewis. Of course, the actresses tended to be more straightforwardly beautiful, but then overwhelmingly so. Think of the wide landscape of Julia Roberts's smile, an American landscape, honest, expansive, full of hope. No, up until now, Henry's face had been of the reassuring kind that made for success on TV. It had lacked the strangeness and astringency that made for cinema, but now, perhaps, it was coming, with age, with hunger. He observed himself in the mirror. He said, ba, 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 pa, 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 red lorry, yellow lorry, red lorry, yellow lorry. How are you today? I'm fine, sir. How are you today? He checked his phone to see if his taxi had arrived. It hadn't. He stepped out onto his balcony to smoke a cigarette, cupping the lighter flame from the blustery river air. A whirring sound, straight and fast, a cormorant flew low over the water. He should be looking at his pages again. He threw the cigarette away and went in.
So I've been talking to Adam Folds. We've been talking about his latest book, Dream Sequence, which is out now in the UK from Jonathan Cape. Adam, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.